Hello and welcome back to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and today I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
Hello, Matthew. And our editor-at-large, Jamie Graham.
Hello, Jane.
Hello. No Jean Graham the dog this week.
He's next to me. He's in the chair by the window, so he may join us at some point.
He may have an opinion. Yes, he may have an opinion. Okay, so this week we'll be looking at Aaron Sorkin's The Trial of the Chicago 7, Bill Murray's On the Rocks, and Craig Roberts' Eternal Beauty. But first, shall we look ahead to another big release that we're currently getting a bit close to for it not to come out? Do we think that 007 will be making his return? It's due in cinemas November the 12th. No Time to Die, the 25th Bond. Do we think we're going to get it?
Hopefully.
Oh, that's very non-committal.
I mean, Tenet hasn't done brilliantly in the States, but it's done well elsewhere. That's a big spy movie. If any movie is going to attract the British public this year, it's going to be Bond. I mean, the Bond films are always absolutely huge. The last two were colossal hits.
Yeah, they take $1 billion, don't they?
Yeah, so yeah, I think this could tempt people. It's probably the only film Boris Johnson would want to see at the cinema this year as well.
Not necessarily a recommendation. Jamie, no. What do you think? Do you think we've sort of got to the point where they're advertising it now? They've announced a podcast. Do you think we're getting to the point that it's a go?
I do actually, partly because I just don't think it makes business sense to pull it again. It would be absolutely disastrous because they've already done the first campaign, then they did the second campaign. If they pulled it again and released it next year and did a third campaign, it's just so much money. I mean, this is why modern day blockbusters have to take three times their budget to have a profit. It's all the marketing spend. They just can't afford to do it again, surely, if they pull it, you know.
Well, it would eat into those profits massively.
I think it was $225 million as a budget, so by that rationale, it has to take almost $700 million to turn a profit. So if you pulled it again and up the expense once more, it just doesn't make financial sense. So if they can release it, I think they will release it.
And also, you know, it'll have no competition in the cinema.
No.
You know, like Tenet's still rumbling along, but, you know, Bond is a major proposition. It's a film that's, you know, built for the big screen. This is a film that people would possibly be enticed to the cinema to see. Bond is a film that your granny loves, you know, teenagers love, doesn't matter your demographic, your gender, your generation. Everyone kind of gets a Bond and fancies seeing what he's up to. And this is Daniel Craig's last go at Bond. So people are going to be intrigued to see what he does with that. It's a watershed moment. So surely people will go to actually see this one. Do cinemas need to have better rules? Are people put off by the fact that it doesn't feel safe enough yet? I mean, Jamie, you've been to the cinema, haven't you?
I've been once. I went to see Tenet. I couldn't resist it. I mean, basically, I'm high risk, so I'm super paranoid about going out the house. And I waited till it had been out almost a month, and I went along because I just couldn't resist it. And there was only about six people in the cinema, so I was thinking, this is okay, I feel quite safe. But then none of the other people, you know, it was only me who had the mask on. And there was no, you know, there's no one at the cinema. There was no one coming in and checking or anything like that. And I understand it's difficult that people would take the mask off to eat their popcorn, to have their drink. But I was looking around, they didn't have their mask on at all. So that's kind of put me off. But then, like I said, I am high risk, so I'm kind of paranoid anyway.
Well, let's hope that cinemas and audiences work together to make this a success, because I think we probably could say that if Bond doesn't come out and doesn't take some money, we're in pretty dire straits in terms of the cinema industry, aren't we? I mean, Cineworld has said that they might go under if Bond doesn't come out. What would that look like, a world without cinema? Okay, so shall we have a look and see what's actually out at the cinema this week? We'll kick off with this. So order, order, quiet in the court for this.
Are the people ready to make opening arguments?
At the defense table.
Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin, Dave Dellinger, Rennie Davis, Lee Weiner, John Froines, Tom Hayden, and Bobby Seale.
These defendants had a plan, and the plan was to incite a riot.
I call this portion of the trial with friends like these.
My trial's begun without my lawyer.
The court assumes you are being represented by the Black Panther sitting behind you.
The riots were started by the Chicago Police Department.
Sustained.
Nobody objected.
This is The Trial of the Chicago 7. For those of us who don't know who the Chicago 7 are, Jamie, enlighten us.
In 1968, at the Democratic National Convention, there was loads of activists turned up to protest against the Vietnam War, that Lyndon Johnson had been upping a draft and more American soldiers were being sent to Vietnam. And I think it was 1,000 a month were dying at that time. So loads of people turned up in Chicago to protest this. During the protest, there were various clashes with the police, and tear gas was used and batons. And then the next year, President Nixon came in, and he and his Attorney General, John Mitchell, rounded up seven activists that they considered the kind of all-star team of the radical left, and they put them all on trial for inciting violence and conspiracy, and they wanted to effectively get rid of them all in one go. So that was the trial of Chicago 7, which happened in 1969. It lasted for 6 months, and it was almost like the first big kind of almost reality TV event that all the cameras were there, the whole world was watching. It became like almost the Academy Awards of protests, that, you know, people were playing up to the cameras and all of this. And that is the trial of the Chicago 7. What we have here is Aaron Sorkin has turned that into a feature movie. It is not the kind of dry courtroom trial you may expect. I mean, a lot of it takes place in the courtroom, but he also flashes back to all the events leading up to the convention, how these kind of protests came together, the actual clashes with the police, all of the violence is restaged on real life events, you know, in Chicago at Grant Park, where they actually happened. They're spliced with original footage from 1968. You know, it has a lot of pizzazz to it, for want of a better word, or a lot of momentum. And it's a typical Aaron Sorkin thing that the dialogue fizzes as well. So even though it's respectful to the trial and it wants to get to the truth, you know, it's not a courtroom drama. It almost plays like a thriller.
Yeah, it does. As you say, this Aaron Sorkin fast-paced thing, you've got a seven-minute sort of talky intro before the titles. So it's just people going, la, 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 la. And it's like, you need to keep up, yeah. Get your wits about you, because we're off to the races. I sort of didn't know a lot about this, and I found it really interesting. And of course, with current events, it feels incredibly urgent and pertinent to the times we're living in and the sort of police brutality that we're discussing as well. So it was really quite fascinating. But let's talk about this all-star cast as well. I mean, you know, it sort of reminded me of something like, you know, the old Agatha Christie movies, or sort of The Towering Inferno, where it's like not a single person in that cast is like a B-movie nobody. These people are such high quality. Matthew, who's in this? Yeah. Let's talk about who's in this.
Well, you've got Eddie Redmayne, Sacha Baron Cohen, Mark Rylance, Frank Langella.
Yahya Abdul-Mateen.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Michael Keaton. Yeah.
I mean, the big question is, who's going to get nominated and in what category? Who will it be? Who will get picked?
Yeah, who's the lead in this? It's very difficult to say.
I think Frank Langella, who plays this horrible reptilian judge, Julius Hoffman, he would be up for Best Supporting Actor. That, you know, he's someone who throughout the trial, he allows a bit of jury tampering. He's always throwing out his contempt of court, you know, to try and shut the defendants up, basically. You know, there's no doubt whose side he's on. Really sort of nasty conservative piece of work. And he was one of the standouts. All the cast are great. Sacha Baron Cohen was fantastic, as well as Abby Hoffman.
Yeah.
But I can see Frank Langella getting an Oscar non Best Supporting Actor for this without a doubt.
Yeah, and at 82. He's 82, is Frank.
Is he really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Doing really well. Sort of meaty work there, and really sort of controlling this room of talent that are all sort of doing their thing. And, you know, he really does sort of preside quite literally over proceedings. And as you say, really does that in such a outrage, just cannot believe the temerity of these young people. You don't have to like him, but you really do understand where he's coming from, and that he is this older generation that just doesn't understand this newer generation that's coming in and saying, we don't want to stand for this. We won't have it.
Yeah.
And that, again, also felt very much like the sort of crossroads that we're at the moment, with various protests that are happening for Black Lives Matter, but also the environment, that there seems to be this sort of dichotomy between the old guard and the new. So, I agree. I think he was really, really excellent. Who else was good?
I really enjoyed Sacha Baron Cohen. You know, I absolutely love him as a comedian. And he is very funny in this film as well. I mean, he gets most of the witty lines. And when he literally performs a stand-up act, that which you see kind of interspersed throughout the film. But he also does get some very serious moments as well. So I think it's a really great step forward for him. It shows his kind of evolution as an actor. So I was really thrilled to see him.
Yeah. And doing the Boston accent with the flat A's, yeah. The car. Go and get in the car. Yeah. Speaking of accents, Eddie Redmayne doing a great American accent. And I actually think I prefer watching him act in an American accent than I do in his sort of Kermit-y English one. He's very good in it. He's sort of playing this very sort of upstanding preppy activist who's at odds with Abbie Hoffman and his sort of yippie ideology. And
then, I like John Carroll Lynch as well, the slightly more straight-laced guy, the kind of the Boy Scout leader.
Yep. Yep.
Who has his moments of flare up as well.
Yeah, and then you've also got Joseph Gordon-Levitt, who's playing this sort of young attorney who really wants to make his career, has been given this absolutely, you know, career-making case, but is torn between his own ethics and that of the government, which that seems to be a theme throughout this for me as well, which is, what are you prepared to do? How far are you prepared to step out of your comfort zone in order to do what's right? Mm. And that's applicable to him, to the previous Attorney General, whether a dramatic arc that's really quite a sort of fist pump in the air, and also to the actual activists who are on trial, who were all sort of trying to work out, what is it worth? At some point, someone asked Abbie Hoffman, you know, what is it worth? And he says, it's worth my life. This is so important. It's worth my life. I think it really asks a lot of interesting questions and really makes you think.
What I find fascinating about it is that Aaron Sorkin wrote this in 2007. Spielberg commissioned him to write it. Spielberg was going to direct it. And then just when he handed in the script, the Writers Guild of America strike happens. So it was all derailed. And by the time people were back at work, Spielberg was doing other projects. Sorkin was working on other stuff. And it's gone through this kind of 13 years of, it was attached to Paul Greengrass for a while and Ben Stiller for a while, and various other actors have come and gone. And what's amazing about it is it's coming out now and it just feels tailor-made for this moment in history.
Yeah.
I mean, you could almost say it feels like it's been rushed out for now.
Yeah.
But it's actually been 13 years in the making.
And Sorkin says he really hasn't changed the script much to kind of match today. It's basically today's events have changed to match 2007. It's just astonishing. And it does make you think, you know, you see these terrible events happening in 1968 and you kind of think, oh, that's all in the past. That would never happen again. We've learned from that. And then you step to 2020 and it's exactly the same. You know, it's really quite depressing.
It did feel very Spielbergian to me, especially the end, the big flourish at the end. I could really see Spielberg getting his teeth into that. It felt very similar to The Post as well, but I did like it more than The Post. It felt a bit more meaty, a bit more polished than The Post from a couple of years back.
And that's not to say it doesn't have hope. Yeah. It does have that sort of Spielbergian hope, doesn't it? I mean, there's one lump in the throat moment that I was sort of wiping my eye with a moment of solidarity in court that happens. And it does end on a sort of note of the whole world is watching, as a sort of cautionary note to politics now, that we were watching then in 1969, and really we should be as interested and ensuring that people are accountable now as we were then. I do think it's incredibly powerful piece of cinema, and it's probably worth the trip to the cinema. What do you think?
I agree. I think it's a really good film and it's really powerful and it's got a lot to say, but it does it in an entertaining package. You know, I think that's what Sorkin's very good at, that, you know, he's quite a political writer, you know, if we go back to The West Wing and stuff with his liberal politics. But he always wraps it up. He always has one eye on the audience and just puts out a package that you can sit down one evening, you know, get your popcorn out, whatever, and just have a really good 2 hours while you're being educated.
Yeah, it's kind of similar to The Social Network in that it's, you know, it focuses very much on a small group of people, but the handling of it, the kind of theatricality of it does suit the big screen. That dialogue is just great. I mean, you can just chew on that dialogue all day long. So it deserves to be in cinemas, I think.
Okay, so if you would like to see The Trial of the Chicago 7, it is in cinemas from this Friday. Okay, shall we move on from a biopic to Bill Murray with this delight?
So Dean's going away a lot, huh? On business trips?
Dad.
Raise your hand if that sounds fishy.
He's not like you. He's a good guy, a great dad.
Sure, it's nature. Males are forced to fight, to dominate, and to impregnate all females.
So this is On the Rocks. Who's on the rocks, Matthew?
Well, this is Sofia Coppola's latest movie. It's her first since The Beguiled. And it's a reunion with Bill Murray, who she obviously worked with before on Lost in Translation and A Very Murray Christmas. But he's kind of the supporting character in this, because the main character is Laura, played by Rashida Jones. She's a New York author. She's happily married, or so she thinks, with two children. But she begins to suspect that her husband, played by Marlon Wayans, might be playing away from home because he's being a bit evasive. He's going on lots of trips at the last minute, working late in the office. So she starts becoming a little bit suspicious of his activity. And then her dad, Felix, who's a bit of a playboy, a bit of a tearaway, he turns up and he encourages her to start spying on the husband. So it's a dad-daughter chase spy mission movie, and they go tearing around New York trying to find out what exactly Dean is doing. And in the meantime, they analyze their own relationship, which is very loving, but at the same time, quite complicated as well. So it's essentially a two-hander. It's Rashida Jones and Bill Murray. Bill Murray plays a very sort of Murray character. He's very deadpan. He's very charming. He gets a lot of the funny lines, but I think Rashida Jones kind of gives the star turn here, really. She's very understated, but her reactions to this kind of guff that he spouts, I mean, he's got a lot of kind of opinions about gender stereotypes, which you get right from the beginning. And she kind of rebuffs him, questions him on his own history. There's a lot of bickering, but you get a lot of banter between them as well. I mean, it's kind of interesting as a complicated relationship. It's not sort of black and white. It feels very rooted in truth about parents and children, especially, you know, grown up ones.
I'm also interested in this idea as well, like she is playing a woman at the end of her 30s, which she discusses because he says women are most beautiful between the ages of 35 and 39. Mm. She's like, great, you know, like I've got months left then. It sort of does look at this idea of women who are like just keeping plates spinning as a mother and also in full-time work and wife and what that looks like and the pressures on that, which is something that I like to see, that she's not just, oh, she's a dolly bird that works in New York and here's dad. She's much more rounded than that.
Yeah, and she's got writer's block as well. That's a kind of running thread through the film. She's trying to deal with this writer's block, you know, along with everything else, she's trying to resolve that and get on with her work. And then that's kind of done in a very sort of relatable way. It doesn't sort of feel sort of big and Hollywoody, sort of classic Sofia Coppola, you know, very sort of observational, nuanced, subtle. I absolutely loved it, I have to say. I really, really enjoyed it.
Would you say it's a companion piece to Lost in Translation? You know, Bill Murray and a young woman, obviously in that, not his daughter, but sort of enjoying a city together.
Yeah, to an extent, yeah, certainly. But probably more so Somewhere, a 2010 movie, which was about a younger dad and a younger daughter. But that was also a city movie where not a whole lot seemed to happen. But you did get very much a sense of the relationship between these two characters and just all these really beautiful kind of small observations of everyday life. I mean, this one is very much like a Woody Allen movie. You could easily see the premise being used by Woody Allen. And obviously with New York, I mean, New York looks so pretty as well. You know, they go to all the nicest bits. It's very picturesque.
And drink martinis and bars.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It lives up to the title with that. And there's a very beautiful vintage car that plays a part in the film at one point as well. But I think this is like the best Woody Allen film that he hasn't made, you know. And it's my favourite Coppola movie since Somewhere as well. I mean,
I enjoyed The Beguiled, so this looks right up my street.
I'm desperate to see it. I mean, you obviously loved it, and I've read a lot of glowing reviews. I'll hopefully be watching it in the next couple of days. I'm a Coppola fan, and like you, you know, I think Somewhere was wonderful. So for you to say it's her best since Somewhere.
High praise indeed, right?
And it's great to see Rashida Jones get a lead role as well, because it feels like she's maybe, you know, she's played a lot of supporting roles, certainly in movies over the last few years. So to see her really shine in something like this, that's very gratifying. And Marlon Wayans is really good as well.
I know, I was going to say, like, I just remember him from In Living Colour, and really I can't get that sort of goofy, broad comedy out of my head, but he's not doing that in this.
No, he's quite sort of shifty as the role demands, so there's a lot of ambiguity to his performance that keeps you guessing. I mean, it's a very small role, but he's lots of fun. And Jenny Slate's in it as well. She has a small cameo that's great, a recurring cameo that will make you laugh. So yes, I would highly recommend this film.
So if you fancy a little bubbly New York action, then that is On the Rocks, which is out in cinemas from this Friday. So from one family to another with this.
suppose there's no such thing as happiness. Only moments of not being depressed. I think I love you.
I definitely love you.
So this is Eternal Beauty, which is Craig Roberts' sophomore directorial outing. What is this one about? I know it's based in a lot of sort of home truths for him.
Yes.
Tell us about Eternal Beauty, Jamie. You were on set.
I was indeed. And the plot is quite sort of simple in a way, but it focuses on Jane, who's played by Sally Hawkins, who's a paranoid schizophrenic. And when we meet her, her life's kind of going okay. She's ticking along quite nicely. She has two sisters, played by Alice Lowe and Billy Piper. Her mum, played by Penelope Wilton, is a very sort of domineering mother and a hypochondriac, always on the phone saying, oh, you've got to come and see me, something's wrong with me. But like I said, that her life's ticking along, then she stops taking her medication for various reasons and her mental health starts going downhill. That's pretty much it as far as the plot is concerned. But it's very much a film about kind of moods and feelings and exploring character dynamics and relationships. Probably from my description, it sounds like it's going to be a very kind of hard watch or depressing or sort of social realism or something. It really isn't at all. That it's very truthful, that you sort of touched on this a minute ago, Jane, but it is based on one of Craig Roberts' family members who is a paranoid schizophrenic. So he's kind of grown up around it. And they had a guy called Paul Fletcher, who was the head of neuroscience at Cambridge. He was a consultant on the film and on set a lot and overseeing the script. So it's very careful to be very honest and authentic to that condition. But at the same time, it's a highly inventive, imaginative film that, you know, it may remind you a bit of Charlie Kaufman or Paul Thomas Anderson. I'm not saying it's that good, because it's not that good. I mean, how can it be that good, that those two absolute masters? But it has that kind of fizz and invention and originality to it. As the camera moves around, there's lots of music. It slips between time frames.
Jane, it sort of reminds me a bit of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Yes, yeah, definitely. I mean, you have Jane played by Sally Hawkins, but we also revisit Jane when she was about 18 and was first kind of showing signs of being paranoid schizophrenic. And she's played by Morfydd Clark, who's a terrific up-and-coming actress who we're about to see.
In St. Maud, amazing. Oh,
she's wonderful. So it kind of slips between these two timelines. And also, what's really clever is because the whole film is seen through Jane's eyes and her mental health sort of pitches up and down, then everything about the film reflects it. And it's done really subtly, so it's not straight in your face. But if you watch carefully, scene to scene, and actually during scenes, the decor changes, the costumes change, the palette changes. And at one minute, it's sort of really bright and sunny, and then it gets quite dark and oppressive. And again, I mean, it's very Kaufman-esque in that way, but there's a lot going on. And, you know, I think it's probably too many ideas in this film and maybe too much going on in a way, but on the other hand, it is so kind of imaginative and there's so much talent on the show that I would really, really recommend it. I think it's Craig Roberts is kind of on a journey to becoming a special director. Just Jim, his directorial debut was okay, was made very quickly, and I think it kind of showed this. And the leap from Just Jim to this is huge. And I really do think, you know, if he's given the money to keep on directing, to keep going on this path, which he very much wants to do, he sees himself more as a director than an actor these days. I think in a couple more films we could have a really special talent on our hands.
And you've been Wheatley or someone.
Yeah, I mean, he's very different to Wheatley in a way, but where they are similar, as they're both sort of a little bit outside the system and idiosyncratic and do their own thing, kind of march to the beat of their own drum, that, you know, I think British cinema now is a lot more exciting and inventive and a lot more going on than it was maybe 10-15 years ago. But if this had come out 10 or 15 years ago, you'd be amazed it was a British film, because it's not social realism, it's not a period drama. Yeah. It's just a really sort of busy, inventive film with loads going on.
So if you fancy taking a look at someone with great potential, spreading their wings and getting in the mind of somebody and really inhabiting a character, this would be the one for you to watch this Friday.
Well, it would. And also, like, we all know what an actress Sally Hawkins is, so you can imagine her playing this role. And she actually worked on it for 3 years. Craig Roberts went to her because she had played his mum in Submarine, so they're old friends, and he wrote this role specifically for her. She loved it, but had to go off and make The Shape of Water, so he waited for her, and he carried on working on this film for 3 years, down to the finest detail. And during that 3 years, she was sending videos, ideas, music, you know, all these different sort of references. They were back and forth, and she really helped tailor this character and poured a lot of sort of personal stuff into it. I think she's wonderful in it, and, you know, if you're looking for film references, it's a little bit Repulsion by Roman Polanski,
yeah,
and a little bit Punch Drunk Love by Paul Thomas Anderson. If you kind of mesh those two films together, you're
that's
kind
a heady
of
mix.
that is heady.
Yeah, it is heady. I mean, it is a real head trip film without doubt, and shot in 35mm, which I always love to see.
Yeah,
like Chris Nolan's and, you know, your PTAs of the world, Ray Roberts very much likes to shoot on film stock, which again brings a real warmth to the film, I think.
Okay, so this is an auteur in waiting, and that is Eternal Beauty, which is also out this Friday in cinemas. Right, it's time for a quiz. And since we've been talking about Bill Murray, and we love him, we are going to have a Murray You quiz.
Something strange in your neighbourhood. Who you going to call?
Ghostbusters!
Something weird and it don't look good. Who you going to call?
Ghostbusters!
I ain't afraid of no ghosts.
Are we ready to go? Who's going to go first? Who is my first willing victim in the Bill Murray quiz?
I'm going to volunteer Jamie Graham.
Oh, look what he did there. For which of these roles did Murray not receive a Golden Globe nomination? Was it Olive Kitteridge, Hyde Park on Hudson, or The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou?
I have no idea, to be honest with you, but I'm going to go with probably the one you'd least expect, because, you know, I think he probably should have got a Golden Globe nomination for Life Aquatic, and that's probably the most famous in many ways of those three titles. So I think it's probably a trick question. I'll go C.
Correct. It was A Life Aquatic. Matthew, including the upcoming French Dispatch, how many movies has Murray made with Wes Anderson? Is it 10, 9, or 8?
Oh, God. He's been in all of them, hasn't he?
I know, it feels like it.
So Rushmore was the first.
Hey, Jamie, you're not helping him out. What are you doing?
Sorry.
He's been help me.
Matthew, one.
One.
Come on.
I'm going to go 10 then. I'm going to go the full 10.
It's 9. He's in Rushmore, The Royal Tenenbaums, A Life Aquatic, The Darjeeling Limited, Fantastic Mr. Fox, Moonrise Kingdom, The Grand Budapest Hotel, Isle of Dogs, and The French Dispatch. So no points for you. All right, Jamie, ready to go back for number 3. Murray makes an uncredited appearance in which John Hughes movie? Is it She's Having a Baby, Uncle Buck, or Curly Sue?
I don't think it's Uncle Buck, because that's the one I know best out of those films. I've got a soft spot for Uncle Buck.
And we all.
Of course we have. So I think it's either A or C. I'll go C.
It's A. She's Having a Baby.
Oh.
Okay, Matthew. The Jungle Book is Murray's highest grossing movie worldwide. What's his second highest? Is it Ghostbusters, Charlie's Angels, or Get Smart?
I don't really think Get Smart. So I think it's between Charlie's Angels and Ghostbusters. I mean, Ghostbusters was absolutely huge, wasn't it, back in the day?
It certainly was.
But it is a bit older than Charlie's Angels. But I'm going to go with Ghostbusters.
You are correct with 296 million. Jamie, what animal does he play in The Fantastic Mr. Fox? Is he a mole, a beaver, or a badger?
I love
this film.
It's a while since I've seen this film, actually, but I'm pretty sure it's a badger.
It is a badger, and he's an excellent badger too.
He is indeed.
I love the fact as well in that film that everyone just says cussing. Cuss that. Oh, cussing hell. Matthew Leyland. What's the name of his bank-robbing clown character in Quick Change? Is it Glum, Grim, or Groucho?
Oh, God. I haven't seen this film for years and years and years. I reckon it'd be Groucho. I reckon it's a nod to movie history, so I'm going to say Groucho.
It isn't. It's Grimm.
Oh, Grimm.
Ah, Jamie.
Who made that?
Which of these stars does not appear in A Very Merry Christmas? Miley Cyrus, Chris Rock, or Tina Fey?
Miley Cyrus is definitely in it. That's one of the few things I remember about that film, because it was.
You're one of the few people that saw it, I think, as well.
Yeah, it was pretty awful, a real disappointment. So what was it, Miley Cyrus, Chris Rock, or Tina Fey? Chris Rock. Don't remember him in it.
It is Tina Fey.
Oh, God.
Chris Rock was in it.
I've wiped that film from my memory. For yes.
And never there isn't enough eggnog to make that a good film, is there?
No.
Okay.
Oh.
Matthew, which famous writer does he play in the 1980 film Where the Buffalo Roam? Is it Hunter S. Thompson, William S. Burroughs, or Jack Kerouac?
I've either seen that film and forgotten it or not seen it, which is not a good start. I don't think it would be Kerouac. Burroughs?
It's Hunter S. Thompson.
Oh.
So, zero for you.
I can see that.
Okay,
see
the that. Last two now. Jamie, what date is Groundhog Day? Is it January 31st, February 2nd, or February 4th? When does Punxsutawney Phil see his shadow or not?
There's so many Groundhog Day, like, just massive Uber fans out there. And I like it, but I'm not one of those Uber fans. You know, I've seen it.
Oh, I love it.
I've seen it three or four times in all the years it's been out. I know some people, you know, fittingly watch it again and again and again and again and again. But I would say I'm pretty sure it's February the 2nd. I do kind of remember that.
Correct. Yeah. Matthew Lynn, there's no hope of you keeping up now, but do you want to have your question? According to Zombieland 2, the subtitle of Garfield 3 is Soggy Moggy, Flabby Tabby, or Icky Kitty.
They're all excellent titles, but I saw this very recently. It's Flabby Tabby.
It is Flabby Tabby, but you sadly have not got enough. Jamie is the winner there. So he gets to have a glass of eggnog and to watch A Very Merry Christmas again. That's your prize.
I can't wait.
Okay, so let's do it again,
Groundhog Day style.
Yeah, just have to watch it on repeat with Sonny and Cher waking you up every day.
Until I go insane.
Yes. All right. So before we go, though, we do have a question from a reader. And this is, if you could travel into the head of any Hollywood star, like being John Malkovich, who would it be?
I'd go for Tom Cruise. I think that would be fascinating. See, a well-ordered mind. It'd be like Inside Out, but you wouldn't have like fear and disgust. You'd have like discipline and bravery and determination all lining up. Yes. Stamina, endurance. Yeah, that would be mine.
Well, Matthew, I was honestly going to go Tom Cruise as well.
How are you?
Just because I would love to know what it's like to be that positive. I'm a hypochondriac, I'm glum, I'm glass half full all the time. And I'd love to know just the energy that comes off Cruise. He walks in a room and he radiates just positivity. And I'd love to know what that feels like. But if I can't have Cruise because you've had him, then I will go the other way and I'll go someone like Charlie Kaufman, because he's probably one of the few people on earth who's even more neurotic and messed up and weird than I am. So I would actually quite like to experience that, so I can think, oh, actually I'm okay. And I'd also like, just his brain is so inventive and there's so many ideas, and you know, he's so clever, such a genius. I'd just like to be on that kind of level for a day and just know what it feels like to be walking around going, God, I'm brighter than 99.9% of people on earth. This is wonderful.
I'd like to travel into the mind of Greta Gerwig, because I think she's very clever and inventive. What she did with Little Women was really fantastic. So she also just seems like a really nice woman, doesn't she? And I feel like she'd have lovely dinner parties and just be really good friends with her friends and a good friend to them. Yeah, I just think it would be very nice to live in Greta Gerwig's head, thinking up Lady Bird and other things. And I'd also be very interested to know what she's currently thinking about, because I'm eager to see what else she will make.
Wonderful, such a talent. I interviewed her and Saoirse Ronan for Lady Bird, and before the interview started they walked in the room together, because I was interviewing them together, and it was the first time they'd seen each other since they finished shooting the film. And there was a good 10 minutes before the interview started when they were just catching up on the sofa, just having a right old chat. And it was the most wonderful thing to see, like what you just said, Jane, about she'd be a good friend and stuff. Her and Saoirse Ronan were just so delighted to see each other, and loads of news and catching up. And I was just sat there, just like bathing in the glow of it.
Just don't get in the way of that. Extreme love.
Fantastic. Yeah. Such bright brains as well. It was great.
Clever, clever women. Okay, so that's it for this week. Next week, we will be seeing what else we have in the cinemas, see if we're any closer to Bond. But for now, let's say goodbye. Goodbye, boys.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me.
Are you sure this is legal?
I don't know. It's fun, though, isn't it?